Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disabilities who have taken from them or are denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those above them. After Wednesday, October 22nd's Economic Non-Review by Ontario Finance Minister Dwight Duncan, I thought we'd take a look at the dynamics of oppression and protest with Fulbright Fellow and Research Fellow Simon Black of York University and the City University of New York. Simon's a pretty quiet guy, so crank your radio up.
Disrespect welcomes Simon Black, Fulbright Fellow at the City University of New York, Research Fellow, yes, at the City Institute in York University?
Yes.
Okay. And a PhD candidate. Your PhD field was?
It's poverty in urban labor markets.
Welcome to the
Doing
show.
In political science.
You wrote an interesting article which sparked this interview. Was it back in August?
It was. Yeah, it was in August.
Yeah, on a guest speaker coming to Toronto, Louis Chouacant, and his views about the role of protest in advancing the interests of people who are disadvantaged. Have I identified the scope of it properly?
I think that's right. Professor Wacom, who is currently on faculty at the University of California, Berkeley, did an analysis of the French riots that occurred, or have occurred, both last year and then 2 years prior, that was sparked by the death of
youths
of color.
Yeah.
Chased into an electricity facility, and were electrocuted and died later on, chased in there by the police.
And there were two of them?
There were two of them, yeah.
Okay.
And that was what sparked the initial riots. And his analysis was that the riots themselves were more effective in bringing about the type of political change that would impact the communities, the poor communities in France, than actual political participation.
The quote that I remember is, the riots were more effective than voting in three elections.
Right.
Yeah. So he did an analysis of the Montreal riots in the perspective of the riots that had taken place in the past in France. This is sort of side finding of his research, that riots were a more effective political tool for disadvantaged than voting.
I think this was it was part and parcel of his research that he's doing on marginalized urban communities, both in the United States and France. A comparison that he's drawn in a book he has out now called Urban Outcasts.
Oh, the book has been published? When?
Yeah, the book has been published.
When was it published, you know?
It was published last year.
Her name escapes me now. He mentions a New York author who had published a study on race and riots. A race, place, and riots in Chicago, New York, and Los Angeles.
Right.
I'll try and look it up while we're on the air and see if I can't incorporate it in the interview. But he didn't mention that he had a book out himself.
Yeah.
So his study's out. What, have you read it?
I've read parts of it. I haven't read it in whole.
Okay.
But a lot of the analysis of the riots was put forward in a lecture he gave to the University of California, Berkeley.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Just soon after the riots actually occurred in France, the second round of riots.
All right.
So it's accessible on the web as well, if you Google his last name. And
his lecture is?
Yeah, you can download it.
Okay, well, maybe we should spell his name for people. Wacquant?
Right.
And his first name, Louis, L-O-I-C.
Right.
All right.
Now, he didn't actually, he hasn't addressed the riots in Montreal. The article that I did, the op-ed that I did for the Toronto Star, was kind of drew upon his analysis of the French riots.
Yeah, to reflect on the riots in Montreal. And your your feeling was that this was a trend that could grow if disadvantage weren't addressed.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I think what happens when these events take place is that there tends to be both a historical amnesia on the part of the media and the general public, but also the generation of a kind of moral panic. When such events take place and there is a vacuum in terms of the general discourse around analysis of why they occur. And what often fills that vacuum is mainstream media's very kind of stereotypical and lacking in any kind of sociological rigor, the type of analysis that they put forward, which tends to look at things in isolation from the broader chain of events and other events that have occurred like this. So there's been riots in the United States and in France, a series of riots in the UK, and now in Canada. So the media never asks, okay, why are these occurring? Why are they occurring in the similar type of neighborhoods amongst disadvantaged communities?
Yep.
Well, those questions are never asked.
That point was brought up in the book that I read. I'm still looking for the author, but the best reporting on these issues was done by white male reporters who were dispatched to the scene and did the best they could, but not sharing anything with the community, inevitably left out a deeper understanding of what had gone on.
Right.
So that the reporting on these riots was the best information that we had, and nevertheless was still flawed.
Yes, and I think that's been typical of the coverage of the Montreal riots as well.
Well, you followed it, did you, in the Montreal papers?
Yeah, if you look through La Presse, it's funny because you see kind of some consistency in the French media, whether it's in France or whether it's in Quebec. There does seem to be a more openness to using social scientists as a source of information and analysis.
In La Presse?
Yeah, in La Presse as well.
Okay.
I mean, that tends to happen in the Star sometimes.
Okay.
But it was, I think the coverage in the French language media was much more in-depth and adept. Than what was done in English.
I just found the author's name. We don't have the background of French colonies to draw on for citizens of color, but it's interesting that we do have the problems with the police and young men of color and violence against them, and we do have the problems of deprivation. The poor in Ontario are drawn to Toronto for its depth and breadth of services for disadvantaged people, and Toronto fights this apparently tooth and nail by scooping these people when they're visible off the street and rehousing them in apartments often so far from the downtown and services that they're effectively isolated. Yeah, they're part of a new neighborhood, but they're part of a new neighborhood that isn't, where the disadvantaged aren't served.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's almost systematically recreating the conditions of the poor French suburbs known as banlieues, in which that poor and marginalized people are on the outskirts of the city, quite a distance from the services they require.
Oh.
And we're seeing that kind of pattern recreated in Toronto, which typically had a large concentration of poverty and marginalized communities in the inner core of the city. So we're almost seeing a suburbanization of poverty. And there's been a couple of excellent studies done by the University of Toronto's Urban Studies Institute, which have looked at the changing patterns of poverty within the city And if you look at 1970s compared to today, you see a migration of the poor from the inner core of the city out towards the post-war suburbs of Etobicoke and Scarborough, North York.
Yeah, and why is that? Obviously the city's driving some of it. I guess shelter values, rents and so forth, and are driving it too. Why else is it happening?
That's the explanations you've given.
Yeah,
are the main
sufficient
reasons to why it's happening. I'm currently in New York.
Yeah.
And you see the same thing happening in New York. It's that once, as the cities transition through the urban crisis of the 1970s, and there's a crisis in the national economies as well, that affected cities, that really affected cities, and New York in particular was on the verge of bankruptcy.
And
with a recovering economy under the political and economic project we understand now as neoliberalism, the rich really returned to the inner city. And with their return to the inner city and the return of investment to the inner city, there's been a massive increase in rents, and governments here and in Canada as well have not been willing to carve out a space in the inner core of cities for affordable housing.
I see.
To allow people to remain within the city and have access to the services that they need. So this is something that's happening across urban spaces, whether it's in New York or Toronto or in London, England.
So at its foundation, it's an economic phenomenon, but the city is not only not impeding it, they're encouraging it.
Right. They are encouraging it. They're encouraging it through urban entrepreneurialism, in which cities really try to attract, in competition with each other, try to attract the maximum amount of investment they can.
I see.
And part of the way they attract investment is showing that they're, a quote-unquote safe and well-managed city. And that means that anybody who doesn't fit into the picture of a safe and well-managed city is pushed to the margins of that city and beyond its limits.
That's a very broad definition. It's almost anybody who's unhappy. It encompasses more than economics, although economics are the biggest part of it, but it encompasses, a good many single women. It encompasses a good many unemployed who would otherwise be well prepared to live in the inner city. It encompasses a whole wealth of people who have in common at bottom only their unhappiness with this economic force and the city's backing of it. And
right.
So for me, it is not hard to imagine the phenomenon of riots, even in Canada, where I think we have to go back 80 years, don't we, to find riots like Winnipeg?
Well, it's funny you mention Winnipeg because the sources of the Winnipeg riots and the causes of the Winnipeg riots is not too dissimilar from what we're seeing now,
right?
In terms of unemployment, marginalization of the working class within the inner city, and the difference with the Winnipeg riots and the riots we see today is that the Winnipeg riots were mainly the cause of a state response to political organization of the marginalized, in terms of going out and demonstrating on the streets their conditions of life.
Right.
And you don't see that kind of political organizing taking place amongst marginalized communities in major urban centers today. And that's really been a failure of the left.
In order to
channel the rage that's in a lot of these communities, especially amongst the youth, into better forms or more effective forms of political expression and activity. Because no matter what we think of riots and the effect that they have in terms of a government response, they're tremendously destructive of the very communities in which they
unfortunately
take place.
Yeah. I had a police woman recently tell me, I said, I really think that the disadvantaged in this in our communities need to express their objections to the way they're being accommodated more forcefully. I think they need to demonstrate. And she said, well, demonstration is, of course, your democratic right. And I kind of cringed at that because I thought, yeah, like you don't understand. This has, at bottom, this has nothing to do with democratic rights. This has to do with survival.
Right.
It's their right as a living animal to protest their extinction. Yeah, I don't think anybody's grasped that it's come down to that. Do we have in France and in Montreal, do we have the same kind of lip service to accommodating the disadvantaged that I see today in Ontario? I mean, we had a government which was openly nasty, you know, the Mike Harris government. They were very frank about their attitude to people who were disadvantaged. But now we have a government which says, well, we realize your needs, you know, but we haven't got a lot of money and, you know, you have to be patient and, you know, you have to bear with us. And yeah, we plan to help you out, but no, we're not sure we can help you out now. Oh, you seem a little upset. Well, maybe we can help you out a little bit, you know. And they seem to be more intent on sucking the middle class identification with disadvantage out of the conflict than they do with actually dealing with it.
Right.
Do you see this in France and in Montreal?
I think you definitely see it in Montreal, in Quebec, more generally, because of the kind of the social democratic orientation of the province's politics.
Mm-hmm.
That, of course, has taken a different direction, and social democracy in Quebec is no longer what it used to be.
Yeah, that's true.
But the rhetoric of social democracy, in terms of social inclusion and social rights, is something that is still there. And it's funny to compare Quebec and Ontario. We had a government with Mike Harris, which was just openly hostile to working class and poor people. We've never seen that in Quebec. Yet the rhetoric that is now being undertaken by the McGuinty government very much mirrors the type of thing that you see in Quebec in terms of social inclusion, and investment, and in at-risk communities. But like you said, when economic...
nothing economic else has changed. Never mind economic times. I mean, before this happened, nothing had changed, right?
Well, it's the thing. Now they have an excuse, right? When we had a surplus, there wasn't the investment.
Yeah.
But now... the need for the investment remains, and it's actually amplified under what seems now to be a certain recession. Now they say they don't have the money to invest.
Yeah, is it fair to call this passive aggression?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah,
I think so. Well, the government's and the government raises expectations in which it has no
intention,
absolutely no intention of meeting.
Yeah.
And now for about 3 minutes of Albert Ammons, The Boogie Rocks. Thank you. You've been listening to Simon Black, Fulbright Fellow at the City University of New York, Research Fellow at York University, and a PhD candidate in political science, talking to us about the nature of the neighborhoods and the response that created riots in France and Britain, and more recently in Canada and Montreal, in response to disadvantage in those neighborhoods.
Economic crises don't mean an end to social spending and an increase in cutbacks to the welfare state.
Right.
They should, and we saw this during the Great Depression, both in Canada and the United States.
Mm-hmm.
It should mean, if we go back to the old Keynesian economic policies
mm-hmm.
of that era,
mm-hmm.
it should mean that we should be investing heavily in public infrastructure and in our social programs
mm-hmm.
And cushioning the fall that many people are going to take during the recession,
yeah.
And that can again spark an economic recovery. But the logic right now of governments both in Quebec and Ontario and Canada, especially with a Harper minority, is that even though we're going into a recession, we have to continue to balance the books and cut back on spending and a lot of rhetoric around belt tightening,
yeah.
which is just going to exacerbate the conditions we see in urban centers in Canada.
If we're in downtown of one of these urban centers and conditions continue to worsen, where should we begin to take precautions?
Well, I guess it depends on what you mean by protecting ourselves. I mean,
that's true. That's a very good point.
If it's marginalized youth protecting themselves from police brutality, that's one thing. If we're talking about middle class homeowners trying to avoid areas that could fall into disorder, that's another.
Yeah.
How do working class families and the poor and marginalized youth protect themselves in a time of economic crisis in which we see governments both at the provincial, federal, and municipal level not really putting forward any plans to deal with the crisis in a substantial way.
So we should come together.
Well, that's the age old question of political organizing and the efficacy of the left in Canada and how it's going to go about responding to the crisis itself. And
yeah.
I no doubt these communities are crying out for not to say that they're passive themselves. There is a lot of organizing that goes on.
Yeah.
In Toronto, but it's by a number of kind of disparate groups that tend not to coordinate their activities.
Yeah. Well, the same
that's
here.
A problem.
The same here. Well, I was at a group recently, disadvantaged tenants, and I asked them if they had been in touch with another group that had issues around tenant disadvantages, and they said, "No, we've never heard of it." I really don't know the way in through the political armor of city agencies who are supposed to be helping these people and supposed to be open to all ideas, and in fact are quite closed.
Right. and we always have to be wary of co-optation.
And, yeah, that's true. Yeah.
A type of tokenism that seems to take advocates and activists and governments pretend that they have an open door to them and allow them to sit on various quasi-government bodies and devise solutions that are never to be implemented.
I'm sure the city likes to keep people with disturbing ideas away from them, is the impression I got, at any rate.
Yeah.
How do people penetrate that? They penetrate it by being offside, don't they? By protesting, by doing the unexpected and hoping that people will notice.
I would argue that history shows that is the way that
mm-hmm.
that disadvantaged people make gains. They don't make gains through participating in the polite political process that is established by those in power.
Yeah.
I mean, the rules of the game have been set by others than ourselves.
Right.
And
they understand.
If you want to play
plot
by those rules, then you're going to be at a disadvantage.
I found the book that I was talking about for people who are more interested in the dynamics of riots and for example, race, which seems to play a big role in the Montreal riot. Janet L. Abu-Lugaud. Abu-Lugaud, Lughod, Race, Space, and Riots. And what was Luis Wacant's?
Urban Outcast.
Urban Outcast by Wacant.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
And it's published by Polity I believe, Polity Press.
Polity Press, okay.
Yeah.
Let me open the web reference and see if I can find out who published Le God. Oxford University Press. There you go. Okay. What do you have to say about protest and political advantage in the current economic conditions?
I think a good term for it is, and this is something that I've learned from Francis Fox Piven,
okay.
who's a professor here at the City University of New York and wrote some wonderful books and,
mm-hmm.
in the 1970s about poor people's organizing and
okay.
Continues to write today. She uses the term disruptive power.
Okay.
And it tries to encompass the way power is organized in contemporary societies.
Right.
And, of course, power is something that is interdependent. The people in power, people who own businesses, rely on workers coming to work.
Yeah.
The bureaucracy of the welfare offices relies on people coming to the welfare office and behaving themselves and going through the typical humiliation and degradation that accessing poor relief entails.
Yeah.
But when we exercise disruptive power, when we don't play by the rules of the game,
mm-hmm.
whether it's workers who go on strike, whether it's the unemployed, blocking off roads or
mm-hmm.
The poor occupying welfare offices,
mm-hmm.
when we exercise that disruptive power, it's then that we see the state respond and governments respond in meaningful ways.
And again, to refer back to earlier in the interview, you thought that the most effective thing that people could do is become aware of one another and work together.
I think
so. It's kind of networking that needs to happen.
There needs to be more. Yeah, there definitely needs to be more interaction amongst the various activist groups that are working around issues of disadvantage and marginalization in urban centers. That's for sure.
I appreciate that. You've been validated by the policewoman who came to my apartment after my last exchange at the Ontario Disability Support Office. And she says, when she leaves, she says, okay, well, you understand the problem now. She says, just mind your manners when you're at the ODSP office. And I thought, well, that's the crime, right? And in a very real sense, you've exposed it as, in fact, the crime is being disruptive.
Right.
And, of course, obviously the way to generate attention.
Right.
Yeah.
That could be a slogan of current governments all over.
Mind your manners.
Yeah, mind your manners.
Yeah, times are tough all over. Mind your manners. Yeah, get back in line. Well, Simon, I really appreciate you coming on the show. Do you have a web presence that people can follow as well?
Yeah, I do. It's www.simonjblack.com.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And there you can access my analysis of the riots. And I write a column in Canadian Dimension magazine.
Okay.
And also contribute to a hip-hop politics magazine, or hip-hop culture magazine called Pound, which is available at Chapters or at HMV.
Cool. Okay. Much appreciated your time today on the show.
Thanks, Jeff, for having me.
Thanks. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Simon Black, Fulbright Fellow at the City University of New York, Research Fellow at York University, and a PhD candidate in political science, talking to us about the nature of the neighborhoods and the response that created riots in France and Britain, and more recently in Canada and Montreal, in response to disadvantage in those neighborhoods. Take some time out with me now before we go to the news review with Big Maceo and Chicago Breakdown. Thursday, October 23rd. Here's the news review on disrespect. Globe and Mail, Saturday, October 11th. Anthony Reinhart. Avoid using restraints, coroner's jury urges. Recommendations include strengthening role of patient advocate after death of man who was tied to bed. Mental health workers should avoid using physical restraints to control combative patients and adhere to far stricter standards when there is no other option but to use them, a coroner's jury recommended. Restrained patients also need faster assessment and closer medical monitoring than that afforded Jeffrey James, a 34-year-old schizophrenic who died at Toronto's Center for Addiction and Mental Health in 2005 after 5 days strapped to a bed. Members of his family did not attend the inquest, nor was any photograph of him shown at the inquest, despite his lawyer, Mrs. Zaghetti's, wish that one could have been introduced. She was the lawyer for the Empowerment Council, an advocacy group for CAMH patients. It's easy to assume that all psychiatric patients are all others, or raving maniacs that you can't relate to who deserve to be tied to a bed, said Jennifer Chambers, coordinator of the Empowerment Council. I think if the public see the people who have actually been in the system and understand that 1 out of 5 people in Canada actually gets a mental health diagnosis in their lifetime, they realize it could be them. It could be anyone they love. Again, the Globe and Mail, the same date, Saturday, October 11th. Officials defend their response to strep outbreak. Nurses with free antibiotics are now being sent to high-risk areas in Thunder Bay, but some say action should have been taken sooner. Sean Lee, a 30-year-old Thunder Bay resident and drug user who became infected last month by the aggressive strain of Group A streptococcus, said he would have been more careful and quicker to seek medical attention if he'd known about the outbreak. He hadn't heard of the outbreak, didn't seek medical attention for more than a week when his 6-foot-2-inch frame had whittled away to 140 pounds. His pants won't stay up, but he's happy to be alive. Some of those who work with the high-risk population, including the executive director of the city's largest shelter and the program coordinator for a harm reduction center, said they were informed of the outbreak in the spring. Both facilities began providing hand sanitizer and monitoring clients for open wounds. Michael Gardam, director of infectious diseases prevention and control for the Ontario Agency for Health Protection and Promotion, said he can understand why Thunder Bay may not have told the public earlier. But he said, if you think you have something that's going to be significant, tell people up front. Group A streptococcal bacteria is ubiquitous. It's commonly found in the throat and on the skin. In rare cases, however, it causes severe life-threatening diseases such as streptococcal toxic shock, pneumonia, and necrotizing fasciitis, also called flesh-eating disease. From the Star, Tyler Hamilton, energy reporter. Price hike punishes energy misers. Homes that use the least electricity will pay 12% more, others 4.5%. For a household using 1,000 kilowatt hours of electricity a month, a new rate will amount to $56, an increase of $2.40 or 4.5%, compared with a charge of 53.6% under current rates. But for any residents that uses 600 kilowatts or less during the winter, it represents a much more significant 12% hike. The regulator increases the threshold where rates change to 1,000 kilowatt hours in the fall-winter season from 600 kilowatt hours in the spring-summer to account for higher electricity use associated with increased use of heating and lighting. As of November 1st, consumers will begin paying 5.6 cents per kilowatt hour of electricity up to 1,000 kilowatt hours each month. Above that, the rate climbs to 6.5 cents per kilowatt hour. The increase doesn't affect customers who buy electricity from a retailer such as Direct Energy. It's also limited to the commodity price of electricity and does not affect the cost of distribution or delivery. The new rate partly accounts for Ontario Power Generation's request to get paid 14.8% more for the electricity it generates from its regulated nuclear and hydroelectric power plants, which represent about 42% of all power produced in the province. Energy Board spokesperson Paul Crawford said the regulator will rule on Ontario Power Generation's request in the next few weeks, but, quote, to be prudent, it was decided that the new rate reflect half of the requested increase. The Energy Board is passing on half of OPG's rate increase, even though it hasn't been approved yet, which means it's almost certainly going to be approved, said Keith Stewart, an energy expert with World Wildlife Foundation Canada. Toronto Star, Tuesday, October 7th. Also the Star, Wednesday, October 8th. Family sue police for $9 million, claiming taser raid on son. I'm a good boy, autistic man, 43 tells officers after they taser him in his bedroom, family alleges. According to the lawsuit filed in the Ontario Superior Court of Justice, George Lochner was in his second-floor bedroom when emergency task force members came looking for his brother Silvano, who was wanted for allegedly threatening to assault his neighbor with a sledgehammer. None of the family's accusations has been proven in court. Police tasered Lochner twice and beat him on his face and all over his body, his brother Silvano, 50, said last night at the family home in a quiet middle-class neighborhood. It was scary. My brother was in his room on the second floor sleeping when emergency task force officers came in with rifles. They said my brother tried to attack them, said Silvano, as he and his mother Lena, 77, showed the Star photos of George's injuries. We have a medical report that says he was tasered twice. Look what they did to him. He's handicapped. He's autistic, said his brother. In the October 8th article, starting slowly and often repeating his words, Lochner explained he was awakened from a nap that day by officers telling him to stand up and show his hands. They pushed him against a wall, he said, and when he fell on a chest of drawers, police tasered him, punched him in the gut and the eye. Lochner, 5'10" and 220 pounds, denies ever provoking the officers or striking back. As evidence of the assault, lawyer Clayton Ruby pointed to photos of Lochner with a black eye, bruised stomach and back, arm and chest riddled with what appear to at least 5 marks inflicted by a taser. Toronto Police spokesperson Mark Pugash said Ruby is missing the point. The issue is whether officers behave reasonably under the circumstances. Pugash said that issue and the issue of whether the warrant was invalid will be determined in court. We reject fundamentally Mr. Ruby's accounts of what happened, he said. We will fight this vigorously. Lochner's mother, Lena, said her son was very gentle to everyone. She said she told police Silvano was not home that August afternoon, but they pushed her aside and entered the home. Court documents show Lochner was arrested in 2006, but don't show what led to the incident or how it was resolved. Before he left the news conference yesterday, George Lochner reiterated, "I told the truth. I told the truth to my mother in the eyes." Acetaminophen linked to childhood asthma. No data on this one, but looking like the Spectator. Children given acetaminophen during the first year of life to reduce fever are more likely to develop asthma later on, a study finds. These children are also more likely to develop rhinoconjunctivitis and eczema when they reach age 6 or 7, according to the report in the September 20th issue of The Lancet. If this association is causative, it would suggest that acetaminophen use is a risk factor for asthma and may explain that asthma has become more common, said lead researcher Dr. Richard Beasley from the Medical Research Institute of New Zealand in Wellington. But since this study can't definitively say that acetaminophen is a cause of asthma, its use for children shouldn't be changed, Beasley added. Beasley thinks acetaminophen should not be used routinely for childhood fever, but reserved for high fevers. Children who were given high doses of acetaminophen within the past year had a more than 3 times increased risk of asthma. Those who were given medium doses had a 61% increased risk of developing the condition, Beasley's team reported. The study, said Dr. Norman H. Edelman, Vice President for Health Sciences and Professor of Medicine at sunny Stony Brook University in New York, said the study is consistent with quite a few others that show that use of acetaminophen is associated with an increased risk for asthma. And a story for which we've already done a short interview. Condo Cash was going to save Regent Park. Kiss that idea and others goodbye. Globe and Mail, Saturday, October 4th, column by John Barber. The most obvious victim of the credit crunch is the city itself, which has invested so much political capital in the promise of ever-increasing real estate values. Sagging values clearly imperil such signature policies as waterfront renewal, the land transfer tax, social housing rehabilitation, and even the vaunted mayor's tower renewal program. Barring a miracle, the new tower now rising at the corner of Dundas and Parliament in Toronto will be the last evidence of the much-anticipated revitalization of Regent Park, Canada's largest public housing project and the city's most ambitious attempt to use condo sales to finance social policy. Although still inchoate, the tower renewal could emerge as the ultimate victim of the crunch. Most of the magic money needed to refinance this revitalization scheme is expected to come from energy savings. Presuming the same economics applies tomorrow, many old high-rises will get new winter coats over the next few years. But the big moves intended to revive distressed neighborhoods as a whole depend on real estate leverage that no longer exists While it lasted, the real estate boom presented an interesting alternative to government-financed social policy. Significant revitalization occurred, but only in locations dictated by the market. The rest of the city waited patiently for a turn. It now seems clear that will never come. Yeah, we have an interview on that with John Hearthstone, a housing economist. One, maybe two interviews with Catherine Boyce Parker about the victory for the homeless who need shelter in Cridge Park in Victoria, and the city's response in introducing, the day after the judgment was passed, a new bylaw which says they have to take the shelter down every morning. So stay with us next week on Disrespect. All these topics, if any of them interest you, email us. dialogue@inbox.com. D-I-A-L-O-G. dialogue@inbox.com. And we'll take your viewpoint into account and chase the stories that you tell us are important to you. Next, the man I predict will be Montreal's most popular house guest on his acceptance by Canadian immigration, musician Cotter Ballooney. In sanctuary for over 1,000 days, in church in Montreal, awaiting approval of his second immigration application to Canada.
You hear me?
Oh, yeah.
No.
Oh, very loud and very clear.
Huh?
Very loud, very clear.
Yeah, but I'm not hearing you very well.
Anyway. Oh, I can up mine, too. There you go. Is that a little better? A little better now?
Yeah.
Okay. So you were saying about the music.
Yeah, I apologize. Just now, I got somebody called me. They want me to do artist project.
Yeah.
I have somebody I don't know what to name this project, but I know it's going to be big gallery.
Wow.
Yeah, and they ask me, I don't know, to give me one space.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, this space is going to be it's musical space.
Really?
And I have to record in here from my room.
Yeah.
And I want to send it to them.
Okay.
And they want to play it in December here in Montreal.
Very good.
Yeah, and I have to practice a lot.
Oh, okay. So this is a live performance by you.
Yeah.
You are the performer. Are you also the composer?
Yeah.
Composer, performer. Very good.
Yeah. You know, I'm not a big composer, but
Yeah, I know. I know. You put out a CD.
I'm copying many things from another big musicians, you know?
Oh, okay.
I'm copying for them. You know?
So you're an arranger then?
Yeah.
Oh,
okay. I take from here, from there, and, you know?
Yeah, good.
Like, do you know the music Love Story?
Yeah.
Do you know this? I made same, but with different notes.
Oh, okay.
And it sounds very, very, very good.
Oh, good.
On the piano, yeah. Yeah, just I have to record it.
Okay.
Yeah, but it's not yet recorded.
And is this for your exhibit in this artwork, or is this something else you do for the art exhibit?
No, this is something else.
This is something else, okay.
Yeah. But I think I want to put it for the gallery.
Yeah?
I think so. Because I was just today, I got the phone just today for the lady. She asked me if I can do that, the woman.
Oh, good.
Yeah. And before you called me,
yeah,
and just check email, and I stopped to check email because you called.
Oh.
I think she wrote something.
Okay.
On my email, yeah.
Okay.
Not my email, my committee support email.
All right. I hear you.
Mm-hmm.
So you haven't checked it yet?
No, I checked it because you called me.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Blame me. Go ahead.
Not me, because I have no idea.
Do you want to check it while I'm on the phone, or can you do that?
Yeah, if you want, I can check it.
Sure, and we'll see if we've got any more news.
Hold on.
Okay.
What she said, hold on.
Facebook, quote, Project X, quote, Demi, a Yonder Gomer sound installation project, 10/21/2312px. Page and one link. Hi, Emmanuel. Hope all is well with you. I'm part of a group organizing a show at La Centrale Gallery. Left parent link www.lacentrale.org. Right parent. The show is taking place 17-21 December 2008 and it's entitled, quote, Border Movements, quote. The objective is to showcase art and artists that have direct relationships with social movements and to engage in a conversation about art and activism on the theme of borders and migration. Would you be interested in collaborating with Cater and together creating a sound installation? You have free range as long as it deals with the theme of the show in any way. If you're interested and available, please let me know that you're in. You can then get in touch with Cater at 514.691.0567. Best, Adiana.
Did you share it?
Yeah. Yeah, I did. So that's the letter you got, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And you have
I talked to a woman. She called me.
So she has not yet responded?
No, she called me.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Because this person talked to another person.
Yeah.
And the woman called me.
Yeah.
Just half an hour before you called me.
Okay.
I'm ready to talk to her.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So you're hoping to get in touch with her tonight?
Hmm?
Are you hoping to get in touch with her tonight? Is that it?
No, she called me.
Yes, okay. All right.
Yeah. Because this message, just now I open it. Maybe I'm late to open because maybe she sent it the morning or whatever.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah, but
so you have to call me. Now you have to reply.
I don't have to reply because I talked to her.
Oh, I see. So this was the message she sent, and in the meantime, you've been on the phone.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Very good.
The woman called me, and that's it. She said she wanted to play it in December.
Okay. Do we know when?
Yeah, she said now 27 or 17, I don't know.
That's a good time, because everybody has lots of time between Christmas and New Year's, usually.
Yeah, it's like... Say 27 or say 17. I don't remember the date.
Okay. A 27th is better than 17th.
I don't know.
Well, yeah, you know, Christmas, right?
But I hope I'll be outside in this time.
Oh, I hope so,
too. I hope I'm not here, man. It's Christmas, man.
Yeah. Well, I suppose you could always volunteer as a Santa Claus, you know? They would never recognize you in a big white beard sitting in a chair.
Yeah. I don't want to take any
Catter Claus.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
But I want to do a good job. She asked me today, she wants to send me somebody he can record in.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I want to do with him this. I want to do some.
All right.
Just I want to talk in, and after it's like two minute talking, I want to play peace music.
Yeah. We haven't spoken since the election either. How did the Conservatives do in your riding? Is there anybody in Montreal who's Conservative MP to see your exhibit and be impressed and raise the issue with immigration? Did they win any ridings in Montreal?
But nobody won.
No Conservatives won in Montreal?
No Conservatives won, yeah.
Okay.
I don't know. The Conservatives had a hard time here in Quebec.
Anyway. Yes, I heard that.
It's a hard time, and yeah.
Well, maybe they have lots of time to go see your exhibit then, if they're not working.
The conservators, it's made something for my case here in Pointe-Saint-Charles. If they had accepted me before.
Now, slow down. This sounds interesting. What did you say, the conservatives? What about your case?
I said if the conservatives, it was accepted me in Pointe-Saint-Charles here.
Yeah.
Everybody going to be vote for it, believe me.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you're probably right.
Yeah, but what you said, that's it.
Yeah. Okay.
And we have good person here in the conservators. That's why I heard.
Okay. All right.
But nobody like to vote for them and
Yeah. Well, keeping you in the dark, no. Okay.
Yeah, I have my points which are here in my area. I have big support, big support. Each home.
Yeah.
Apartment?
Yeah.
The North situation is very angry.
Yeah.
You know the guy, the block, he, you know what he did?
Well, no, what did he do?
He took my picture with his picture, and he sent like a whole the citizen of Ponce and Shore, population of Ponce and Shore.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So you're pictured together?
Yeah.
Oh,
with
wow.
Me, and like, yeah, that's, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
But he's worked hard on my case, too.
Yeah. Well, Block is powerful, you know?
Yeah.
Then nobody can shake their vote. It comes out the same no matter what.
Yeah, but like it took 50, man, 50 cheers. Wow, win for 50.
Oh, 150 seats, yeah. Yeah.
50 seats, man, and that's not a lot.
Yep, that's right. No, we call them seats, not chairs, but I know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
It's the same. Yeah, it's the same thing. I had to think for a minute.
Yeah, just a lot.
Yep. Oh, they always win a lot, it seems, you know? It doesn't seem like anybody's going to take anything from them.
Yeah, but it's almost the second. It's like it's good position. Like you have good position, you know.
Yeah, they do.
Because the liberal doesn't have much. Then
no, well, the liberals don't have credibility either. Unfortunately, that nobody takes them seriously right now. They're waiting for them to, you know, have a convention, elect a new leader, see who it is, see what they say.
Yeah, and if you see also, if you see the conservator has 142 seats, and that's it. It's like if you compare with the Bloc Québécois, the Bloc Québécois has five times more than the seat, more than conservators. I don't know if you understand I don't know if you understand what I mean. Because the conservatives cross Canada.
Right.
And we have 10 provinces.
Right.
You know, 10, like...
10 provinces.
Provinces.
Three territories, yeah.
Yeah, and the conservatives took 142.
Yeah.
And the Bloc Québécois, only Quebec, 50.
Yeah. I think a lot of people, sounds silly, but I think if the Bloc had had candidates outside Quebec, a lot of people would have voted.
Would you vote for them? Yeah, I heard that.
Yeah.
I heard this.
Yeah, I believe it.
Yeah.
So who knows what happens in the next election?
Oh, the chief, Gilles Duceppe, he did a good campaign. He went to Toronto.
Yeah.
Yeah, he went to Toronto, but for sure, Harper, he won't change his philosophy, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Because Harper is smart.
Okay. Yeah, well, we'll get the chance to see now, won't we? I mean, he has more power, but he still doesn't have a majority, so...
No, he's not having a majority.
He has to be smart.
Yeah, but he's very smart.
He's a very bright man, yeah.
Yeah, and he's... Well... That's Aden, the calling for prayer.
Okay.
No.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll let you go, eh?
It's 6. It's almost 6.
Okay. All right. Well,
okay.
We'll let you go to prayer. And thank you for sticking with us through this interview. Yeah. We'll talk to you again next Monday at 3:30.
For sure. Okay?
All right.
Take care.
Take care. Bye.
Bye.
Going out, pianist Henry Gray. And Henry's House Rocker. You can now listen to the show wherever you're near an internet download. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at Showtime to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.